in my parking place at my condo in.
Good afternoon, everyone. I would like to call the Joint Committee on Legislative Administration to order. Good to see you all, colleagues. On our calendar today, we will have some brief items, and then I would invite all of you to visit, I forget which hearing room.
350.
350.
350, where there are displays regarding the some of the capital renovation concepts. So we won't be discussing that today, but we wanted to provide some time that you might have on your calendar today to go see those drawings and things upstairs in 350. So with that, I'm going to open a public hearing on the review of an appointment to the Oregon State Capital Foundation. And we have some guests today, some of my favorite people. It's good to see you. Please introduce yourself for the record, and we have an appointment to the foundation to consider.
Thank you, Madam Speaker, and President Courtney, and members. My name is Jane Cease. I'm currently the chair of the Oregon State Capital Foundation. I have with me Gary Wilhelms, who's the chair of the nominating committee. We have with us the person who is being nominated today, Kim Duncan, who can answer questions. We can answer questions. We can talk or shut up, whatever you want us to do. And he can't talk, so.
Yes, for the record, Kevin can't speak right now, so.
Can we pick options for Gary?
Well, you know, I'm sure Jane has captured everything that Gary would want to say.
She certainly has, Madam Chair.
There you go. Well, it's Gary and Jane. It's both nice to see you. Senator Johnson, do you have a question?
I have a question, and this has absolutely nothing to do with today's nominee, who has been a good friend for a lot more years than either one of us want to cop to. But it's a more global question. Having been a board member of the foundation and having watched sort of the evolution of policies and procedures, I'm just curious how the nominating committee goes about vetting candidates, because one of my criticisms of the foundation is that it has been largely a closed shop of insiders of long duration and heavily experienced. And I'm just trying to figure out, somewhere out there, there might be some budding historian or somebody who may not have ever been informed of this opportunity to serve. And I think that there is some value in having a process that invites those new voices, especially when you're raising money.
Senator Johnson, thank you. The
For the record, you are?
Gary Wilhelms, chair of the nominating committee for the Oregon State Capital Foundation. It's interesting that you bring that up, because for about 2 years now, we've had a development committee as part of our organization, which has basically been taking a look at the future of the Oregon State Capital Foundation. And the membership of the foundation is a matter of great concern to us as well. We're going to be having a bill proposed in this session to kind of restructure the foundation and its oversight here in the legislature. But as part of that, we're creating an actual board of directors of the foundation, which it does not have now. And I have personally just rewritten and gotten the approval of the other members of the executive committee for a process for vetting new members of the foundation. It's our intent to reach out and keep a balance between the gray hairs that have been around the building for a long time and whether or not they have gray hair or not, people outside who are connected who are connected to the money and history, you know, that's right. So we are working toward achieving exactly what you're talking about.
Madam Chair?
Yes.
A couple of follow-ups. The old axiom that I've heard in board service before, with the three W's and somebody added a fourth: work, wealth, wisdom, or wallop, and the wallop is the ability to be a pathway, open a door to a high donor. One other interesting thing that I might offer for your consideration is the possibility of having some student seats, an opportunity to grow your own board members, to take some promising high school kids and introduce them both to board service and good governance and boardsmanship, as well as their capital and participation in planning for the future of a great public building. it might just be a thought, but to have a process that is a more inclusive process. It's been somewhat the same way with some of the monuments that have occurred. It's been an insider's game, and I think if the foundation is going to reach its full potential, that at some point it needs to appear not to be as clubby as it is.
I think it's a wonderful idea, and you know, you're absolutely right, and the foundation recognizes the clubbiness of its existence up to now. And so we are with you, and we are trying to change that. And the work of this development committee has been very, very professional and very good. And I think it bodes well for us achieving what you're talking about. We have maintained vacancies on our statutorily limited membership at the current time so that we can, once we get the final approval of all of the process we're doing, now that we can reach out and fill those slots with the kind of folks you're talking about.
Thank you. Excellent. Thank you, Senator. Representative Putnam.
Thank you, Madam Speaker. Along those lines also, we're working to have all committee members educate the public, to go to civic clubs. I've committed to try to step in and educate legislators, because a lot of legislators don't know there is a foundation or what we do. So we're committed to that. Also, Gary didn't mention that there was kind of a member duty profile written up too that has changed. And our last board meeting, I understand that one or two people actually even said, okay, I'm not a good candidate because it's going to be a working board, maybe more than in the past. But I don't want to speak for Gary, but.
And colleagues, if not aware, there are legislative members on the foundation, and I forget how many there are, but there's three in each chamber. So.
Following on Representative Huffman's comments, one other thing I would say, having served in the not-for-profit and charitable sector, I think that there ought to be an obligation of membership on the board that you are a member of the organization. Many large foundations will look at a board and see if there's not full participation. They won't help. If your board members are not invested with a stretch gift into the organization, why the hell should anybody else invest in it? And so if this is going to morph eventually into a more professional board, that you're out raising serious money, and your new nominee knows this better than most because she's raised a ton of money over time, it may be emulating some of the practices that are currently observed in the broader charitable community might be helpful to put that patina of professionalism on the foundation that serves this building and its history.
Once again, I couldn't agree with you more, and the stretch gift is actually a part of the job description that has been that was mentioned by Representative Huffman. It's there.
And it can be give it or get it. You don't have to burrow into somebody's pocketbook, but you can give them the obligation to go burrow into somebody else's pocketbook.
Correct. I mean, thank you.
Thank you, Senator.
We're
final
with you,
comment, Representative. A final comment by Madam Chair.
Well, and along those lines, Jane, I'm going to steal Jane's lines. Fred actually has tickets in his pocket for a fundraising raffle that we...
Excellent. And I want to thank Representative Huffman for his dedication to the foundation.
Okay. Madam Chair, I was just
Chair Cease, do you have a final comment?
Yeah, thank you. I was just going to say, I think that I'm pretty sure almost every member currently on the board is making a substantial contribution fiscally, monetarily. And if they're not, we'll get them.
I just feel compelled to do it. It's not so, for some people, the monetary participation might be impossible. So you could monetize their time.
Right.
Just some way to show that the board is completely invested and this isn't just an honorific that they put on a vita.
And Madam Chair and Senator Johnson, we have been given assignments by our development person to do some more contacts with people. And I have to say I haven't done all of mine yet, but I promise I will this afternoon. Anyhow, so I just need to get myself to my computer. I've been away from it for a while.
Yeah.
Well, thank you for the comments, and obviously, you know, we appreciate all the volunteer work that the members of the foundation do, so thank you so much. With that, I'm going to close the public hearing on the appointment to the Oregon State Capitol Foundation, open a work session on the proposed appointment to the Oregon State Capitol Foundation. Representative McLean.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I move the committee accept the recommendation of the Oregon State Capitol Foundation and appoint Ms. Kim Duncan.
Thank you, Representative. Representative McLean moves that the committee accept the Capitol Foundation's recommendation and appoint Ms. Kim Duncan to the Oregon State Capitol Foundation. Is there any discussion? I think Kim would be a great add, so thank you, Kim. Is there any objection to the motion? Seeing none, motion carries, and I will close the work session. Thank you. Thank you all for being here. I will now open an informational meeting on the review and approval of recommended updates to legislative branch personnel rules. So, colleagues, I don't know if you recall, because I can't remember who all served, but 2 years ago we did a very large update to the personnel rules of the legislative branch, something that hadn't been done, I want to say, in a decade. So it was a massive work. A lot of that happened under co-governance. There was a lot of bipartisan cooperation to do that, all good things. And now, only 2 years later, we're seeing some changes again, which I think is good, because these things should not wait 10 years for changes. And so you have a set of changes in front of you, and you have a cover sheet that explains the different rule areas. And I'm going to ask Legislative Administrator, although poor voice, we'll bring someone up to talk to walk us through this. I will add, we could entertain a motion when we get to the work session portion to approve all of these or only parts of them. I recognize, I don't think you've had more than a couple days to look at them. I don't think they're controversial necessarily, but don't feel that we have to approve them all today, but I certainly entertain that as well. So with that, in lieu of Kevin Hayden, our administrator, who has a bit of laryngitis, we're sorry to hear that.
Co-chair, COTEC co-chair Courtney, members, good afternoon, Dexter Johnson, Legislative Council. And I'm here to talk about the rules. Madam co-chair, you were absolutely correct that there was a comprehensive rewrite of these rules that took about 2 years to develop and then was presented to you about 2 years ago. You adopted those rules, and this is the first time that they are being modified in any way. And all of these changes, with perhaps one exception, are purely housekeeping. And I can walk through them very briefly, if that's the committee's desire.
Yes, please do. That'd be great. Thank you, Jackson.
All right, so start with Rule 4, which basically makes two changes. The first is that it limits for part-time employees the percentage by which they can be employed to a series of percentages. There's quite a few of them. You'll see them on page 2. So basically, when you hire someone part-time, they have to agree to work for one of these percentages of a full-time equivalent position.
Yeah,
eases the amount of customization that must be done in computing one's pay. It's the main purpose for that.
I.e., not 33%, not 37%, not, you know.
Correct.
Yes.
And the other change is simply to reflect current practice. It's over in subsection 10, and it concerns comp time. If you are awarded comp time, which is to say payment for overtime that you otherwise worked, you must use that comp time within 18 months of the date it was awarded.
Madam Chair.
Maybe we'll do it one section at a time. So that was all for?
That is all for rule
Rule number four. So questions on rule number four before Senator Johnson.
A sort of global question, and that is the effect of these employees not hired at less than the current Oregon minimum wage. These are not traditional jobs for some of the legislative staff, and I presume that these rules are extended to staff as well, are they not?
Co-chair and Senator Johnson, yes.
So
they apply to everyone in the branch.
I guess generally. As I've been thinking about this, because these are such atypical jobs with, particularly at the end of the session, bizarre work hours, and these are not your standard 8-to-5 someplace. And in some cases, I mean, I've made the election in my office to pay people when there is not much work to do in order to keep them when there is too much work to do. And I'm wondering the effect on flexibility in the offices if you count aggregate hours, particularly at the end of a session, and it slips down into being less than minimum. So that's question number one. Question number two, what effect this addition about the less than Oregon current minimum wage would have on the ability of any interns to be in the building? Where they're gaining job experience, resume building, those sorts of intangible benefits that might in some cases be worth more than the salary.
Madam Co-Chair, Senator Johnson, first, let me respond to your practical question of what does this change do when you are wanting to keep someone on at perhaps a very low period of time and low salary because there isn't that much to do, but you want to keep them on for later when there is. And this rule, the effect of it would be to require you to have them in this 20%, if you look over to the other side, 20% category, and whatever they actually work, that has to add up to at least equal to Oregon minimum wage. Now, I should note that this, I think, really is the result you must comply with anyways under Oregon law. And so this is simply to avoid ambiguity in that
That's helpful. Context. Thank you.
The intern question, though.
The intern, okay, yes. The intern question. Interns are not paid salary, generally, and they are receiving experience in lieu thereof. And so interns generally do not need to receive any pay. However, there must be, you can't just have someone come in off the street and be a, quote, intern. They have to be somehow affiliated with an educational institution or something where they're gaining, where this will not necessarily reflect credit, but will be support their degree or something of that nature. Otherwise, they're a volunteer, and they're that also is okay, but it's just a different category under these rules.
And the distinguishing feature of either the volunteer or the intern is that they could not be paid at all, but under certain circumstances in the building. This would not preclude somebody, me, from bringing down an aspiring law student who wanted to see how this process worked. I don't want to shut the door on that kind of experiential opportunity.
Madam Chair, Senator Johnson, that's correct. They can't be paid at all. They can receive reimbursement for any expenses they incur.
Mileage, overnight, that,
correct.
Okay.
Yes.
Thank you, Senator. Questions, Representative McLean?
Thank you. Just to clarify, if a graduate of a law school who is no longer maybe someone who passes the bar looking for a job, maybe working some part-time hours at some law firm or whatever, and wants to come in and work as a research policy intern or something like that. Take a situation where you're graduated, you've passed the bar, now you're just doing it because to get some experience and learn a bit. How does that fit in this? Is that a volunteer and permissible?
Madam Chair, Representative McLean, yes, that would be, I would characterize that as a volunteer. That would be permissible.
Didn't follow up. And then following up to Senator Johnson's question about, you know, work them like a dog during session and then let them coast a bit during the summer. So, and I paraphrase, but I want to ask you a hypothetical question. Let's say I'm from West Eugene, kind of Junction City area, and I have a person who's on staff at 40 hours a week all year round, and I pay them above Oregon minimum wage. But it's recognized by me that during session, they're working more than 40 hours a week because it's session. And then when we're at a session, you know, it's flexible. It's, you know, sort of realize that, hey, you know, during session, it's all hands on deck, excuse me. When we're at a session, it's pretty easy going. But they're paid the same in February as they're paid in August. Is there any issues with that?
Madam Chair, Representative McLean, it depends in part on whether they are a non-exempt or an exempt employee. If they're an exempt employee and full-time, that amount has to exceed the minimum wage, but overtime doesn't count. If they're non-exempt, then they're eligible for and will receive time and a half overtime for periods over 40 hours. It still have to be minimum wage.
Okay, may I follow up then? Mm-hmm. So I guess that makes sense. Then perhaps what might be helpful is that members are briefed on how to put people in exempt or not exempt categories in the legislative office when we're in session only periodically. And
the question, or the answer to your question, turns on federal law and what they are doing in their work, and Lord Christopher just informed me that all legislative assistants are exempt employees.
Okay, good.
Yes.
Never mind.
Senator Girard?
Thank you, Madam Speaker. I want to make sure I'm reading this correct. When I look at page 2, it says a part-time employee may be scheduled to work for only one of the following percentages of full-time work. And then you list 20, 25, 40, 50, 60, 75, 80, 90, 95. This is a bonehead question, but are we eliminating the dollars per hour? I mean, is that totally gone now? So if we wanted to hire somebody for $15 an hour for 4 hours, we can't do that? I mean, I'm getting nods that that's what you're saying. I don't understand why we want to tie ourselves in a knot here and eliminate that from being a possibility.
Senator, that's an excellent question. My understanding is because there's been so much variation on how people calculate the percentage that it's made it very onerous from a
bookkeeping
perspective, but please announce yourself for the record, and maybe that's what you're going to answer to.
Hi, Lori Christopher, Human Resources Director, Co-Chair Kotek, and Senator Girard. What's happening now is exactly that. A member will come into us and say, I want to pay them $15 an hour. And so we would try to have them designate how many hours that would be. We're on a automated system called TrackStar that you all are familiar with. And so every time that we deviate from a pay plan, those have to be entered manually. We had 37 individual percentages, because we would do exactly that. You would come in and say, I want to pay them $15 an hour up to $500 a month. And it wouldn't fall into a percentage, and so we would have to backwards figure out what the percentage is. And it might be 7.75%. Or it might be 37.19% in order to make that $500 work. So we are limiting what you can do so that we don't have to manually build, in effect, 100 pay tables. Because we could have, TrackStar would allow us to have 1% all the way up to 100% of a pay table.
But you start at 20%. So, I mean, if you just wanted somebody for a few hours, I'm just trying to figure out how that would work. I mean, you have to.
We went from experience, and based on how members are using their staff, 20% is 8 hours a week. And so we didn't have members that were using staff at less than 8 hours a week. So that's why we started at 20%. So it was based on our experience level since the initiation of TrackStar, which I think has been, I want to say 2 years.
2 years. And if you recall, the reason we went to TrackStar, there was some debate about how we were tracking people's hours, and TrackStar is now the system by which we work. And while, as members, we are the employers, and we said, you know, we can determine these things, we're also working within a system that serves the entire branch, and so trying to find some standardization for just working within this TrackStar system is the goal of this rule. So, other questions on rule number... Four. None. We're moving on to rule number 7, which is a new rule related to employment documents when someone is hired.
So rule 7 is entirely new. Now, I don't know if the copy that you have has got these marked up, but ignore that if it is.
No, it's not.
Okay, that's good. The rule is entirely new, and it is essentially a tool to assist in compliance with federal law requirements. Federal law requires that a new employee document their eligibility for employment by presenting certain documents, passport. I know there are other documents too, but that's the most well known. And this rule is designed to essentially help employee services to ensure that that federal law is complied with. In addition, there is also emergency contact information, which Employee Services also wants for a variety of practical reasons, and this rule will help them to ensure that they have the emergency contact information as well.
Thank you, Dexter. So again, these aren't things that are on, you know, not surprising list, but it makes it clear that we need them, and that Employee Services will follow up if they don't have them. Occasionally we have members who aren't as dutiful in getting their paperwork in, so this is just clarification in the rules for that. Questions about rule number 7? Okay, moving on. 14, vacation.
Madam Chair and members, this rule is probably the one that I would characterize as not as housekeeping. It is a policy change. And you will see that change over on page 3, subsection 8, and it increases the number of vacation hours that an employee may request payout for from 60 to 120 hours, and it changes the timing of that. It is per fiscal year under this rule. Currently, it is per calendar year, and there is a... This is existing, but there is a requirement that in order to be eligible for that, you must take 40 hours of vacation leave in the previous 12 months before making the request. That's the substance of that change.
Thank you, Dexter. So again, obviously we want people to take their vacation time to be able to be paid out for the 120 maximum that's being suggested up from the 60. You have to have the 40 hours during the last 12 months. Unfortunately, I think we occasionally have employees who don't take enough vacation time, and this has arisen. So questions about this policy shift from the fiscal year and also raising the number of payout hours provided the initial criteria is met? Nancy, Representative Nathanson, excuse me.
How often does this happen?
I'm going to ask
It's rare, but there are a lot of long-term employees, and so the accrual rate is 19.34 an hour. I'm sorry, co-chair Kotek, Representative Nathanson. They can bump up against the maximum, and then they start losing vacation. And with annual sessions, there's a little bit more prep time that goes into it. So it's been expressed to us. This was Ken Rocca who brought this to our attention, and it's been expressed to us that it's very difficult to do. But it's very rare. Less than 5 employees a year request this.
Thank you.
Thank you, Representative. Any follow-ups? Any other questions on this rule? Okay, seeing none, let's move on to 15, family and medical leave.
Madam Chair, members, this rule is purely housekeeping. It is to bring the Rule 15 family and medical leave rule in compliance with federal law. And
that's what I thought.
The changes, are they highlighted in the...
We have 2, notice to employer and then the one on the following page.
Okay, very good. I want to make sure you saw those changes.
When I have trouble reading the red, let me just wave and we'll make sure we'll point it out. Thank you.
The The change in subsection 8 is that it provides in the rule what is currently required anyways, that if you are claiming medical leave for 3 days or more, that you must document, is it 5 days? I'm sorry, 5 days or more, that you must provide medical documentation for that leave, whether it's for you or if you are claiming family medical leave to take care of a family member. Then the other change, which is on the third page, subsection 9B is it's just a clarifying point that if you're claiming family medical leave, you still must pay your whatever your share of health insurance contribution was, you must continue to pay that. And those are the two changes in rule.
Any questions about Rule 15 changes, Senator Johnson?
Is that all to comply with federal law?
Madam Chair, Senator Johnson, yes.
Correct?
Madam Co-Chair, Senator Johnson, it's not to comply with federal law. Used to be that the insurance was 100% paid by the state of Oregon, and since there became premium shares, it wasn't written into the rule that the employee would be responsible to continue their premium share. While an employee is on Federal Medical Leave Act or Oregon Federal Leave Act, we pay for their insurance. But it used to be 100%. Now they have to pay 5%. So all this does is clarify we're going to pay 95%, but they must continue to pay the 5%. So that's to comply with PEB rules.
One more question.
Yes, follow up.
What's the length of time?
12 weeks.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. I just couldn't remember.
Thank you. Looks like we can move on to, I believe, the last item. Rule 18 is holidays.
Madam Chair and members, the change here is really to reflect the reality of annual sessions and that the legislature is always in session during President's Day. The change here is to provide, and it's in subsection 5, that administrative leave is granted in lieu of President's Day. And the reason for this is because of a quirk in either time, it's in the state payroll, in TrackStar, or is it in the state payroll system?
Oh.
It's in both. To have it be administrative leave, that would make it automated. If you didn't make that change, it would have to be a manual process that they would go into to enter that.
And this has been the practice, we're just clarifying.
No, Madam Co-Chair, this has not been the practice. What's the practice is that OSPS already has it prescribed as a legal holiday, but some folks work, so then we have to contact every employer, which is all 90 members and all of the managers and all the supervisors, to inquire whether or not the employee worked, and then determine if they worked, we pay them. If they don't work, they're okay, they've got the holiday pay. So this way what we'll do is just do an automated, everybody gets the administrative leave, it doesn't matter whether they worked or whether they didn't, they'll notate it on their timesheet or in TrackStar on the day that they use it.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Oh, all the intricacies of how we operate here. So, any questions about holidays? Any other questions for Representative McQueen?
Ma'am, it's 8 hours of administrative leave.
Or proportioned based on part-time or not part-time.
So no, like, time and a half comp?
No.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Representative. Other questions for our guests? Senator
Gerard. Oh, thank you, Madam Speaker. I'm still, I really do, I'm a little slow on the uptake, and I'm still back on the first one. And
that's okay, it's the Senate, we give extra time.
Okay, and I'm really scared, but I'll, never mind. the reason I'm a little bit confused is who sets the rate for a full-time employee? Because if you're going to hire a part-time person, you got to hire them at 20, 25, 40, that sort of thing. But that's the percentage. Who sets the rate for the full-time employee that they're going to be a percentage of?
Madam Co-Chair, Senator Gerard, it's 40 hours.
No, 40 hours, I understand the hours, but how about the rate?
It has to be anything above minimum wage, you set the rate. But it has to be Oregon minimum wage, but you would set the rate. So it would be 40 hours times the Oregon minimum minimum pay rate. It has to be that much, but you can set it anywhere above that within your within the budget that you're given.
And just to clarify, so we get, I remember we get to some of the personnel forms. I think there's a base.
There is.
There's a full-time base. That many of us pay above, but it's already.
Well, I understand that, but
we list it on your personnel action when you hire staff.
To be a full-time person, they have to make a certain amount.
Correct.
Many of us pay above that. But.
Well, I know, but I mean, if you wanted to go back, pay $20 an hour, you just got to go through the calculations, and then away you go.
Right.
I mean, you could.
Co-chair Kotek Sandrod will help you do that.
Yes.
You have to pay Lori more than minimum wage. That's the bottom line.
I mean, the practical effect is we know that number that's provided on the personal action form is full-time at least minimum wage.
Correct.
And so anything above that will meet the goal, and when you take a percentage of that, it's still fine. So it's for a practical matter. So
much for the paperless office. How about
other questions on the rules? If not, I'm going to thank you very much. We're going to close the informational hearing and open a work session on the review and approval of recommended updates to legislative branch personnel rules. Representative McLean.
Thank you, Madam Speaker. I move the committee approve the legislative branch personnel rules as amended.
Thank you, Representative. Representative McLean moves that the committee approve the legislative branch personnel rules as amended. Is there any further discussion?
There's none on the Senate side.
Not seeing any further discussion. Is there any objections to the motion?
Not on the Senate side.
Seeing none, motion passes.
None on the House side.
And I will close the work session on the personnel rules. Before I adjourn, just to remind people, in room 350, there are placards and designs about the various conceptual parts of the capital renovation project. If you haven't had a chance to review those, now's a good time to do it since we were scheduled to go to 5 o'clock, unless you have to get on the road. But you'll want it. Now's a good time to go take a look at those. There are staff up there to answer questions in room 350 on the Capitol project. Thank you all for serving. Many of you will be back to join us in the full session in January. It's been a pleasure serving with you on the Legislative Admin Committee.
I got a couple of not coming back.
We are adjourned.
Hey! I missed.
Based on their behavior.
Not coming back.
We are adjourned.
Hey!